Apple is moving to the Beat. The company's made it official. It is buying Beats Electronics, which streams music and makes the popular Beats headphones. Rumors of this deal leaked earlier this month. All told, Beats came with a $3 billion price tag, the largest acquisition in Apple's history. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, it's a deal that has some analysts scratching their heads.
Apple's the company that transformed music for the digital age. With iTunes and the iPod, it developed some of the most innovative and high-quality technology of our time. Beats, which was founded by Dr. Dre and music impresario Jimmy Iovine, makes headphones that many consider so mediocre that they inspire YouTube satires like this one.
I only wanted the Beats because I liked the way they looked. And they're endorsed by the second coolest living rapper.
So why is Apple paying so much for Beats?
At first, the news was certainly puzzling to me.
That's Mike McGuire. He's an analyst with the research firm Gartner.
But I think what we're seeing is Apple realizing, you know, as dominant as they are and as iconic as they've been, there are other products that have built up great affinity as well and demographics that are probably going to be increasingly important to companies like Apple.
And here's the other thing. Even if a lot of music snobs don't like the sound of Beats headphones, Mark Richardson, the editor-in-chief of the music review site Pitchfork, says Beats headphones are perfect for what a lot of millennials are listening to because they emphasize bass.
In the last 5 or 6 years, the rise of like EDM music, this kind of festival-ready electronic dance music with super deep bass, that's just become a much more popular thing along with the rise of Beats.
And along with those headphones and audio gear, Apple purchased Beats Music, a still small streaming service. Apple is late to the game on streaming. Spotify just passed 10 million paying subscribers. Apple could have built its own streaming service, but there's some mistrust by music executives who never felt happy with the way Apple set prices and dominated downloads. By buying Beats, says analyst McGuire, Apple's also getting Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, two men with good music business connections.
It's not just the internal team that built the brand. It's all those partners those folks worked with, right? Those sorts of contacts are, you know, yeah, very important.
In a press release, Apple CEO Tim Cook says, "Music holds a special place within our hearts at Apple. That's why we're bringing together these extraordinary teams." But many Apple lovers fear that the acquisition is another sign that the company is losing its mojo since the death of its visionary founder, Steve Jobs, who many believe would have built his own headphones or streaming music service. James McQuivey, an analyst at Forrester Research, isn't buying it. He says Apple has been working on wearable technology, stuff like smartwatches and other fitness wearables. Beats could help them with that market.
If Beats is worth $3 billion to Apple, it's not for the revenue, it's not even for the brand, it's for the ability to put big technology on your body, and that's something that Apple would want to do.
And now that Apple owns some big headphones, it's something it's going to do. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
There are a lot of concerns these days about the out-of-control collection of personal data online. But at the University of Washington, researchers are thinking much further ahead. They're already worrying about how to keep marketers from tracking our brains. NPR's Martin Costi reports from Seattle.
For just a few $100, you can buy yourself a consumer-grade brain scanning device. Technically, they're called brain-computer interfaces.
With the emotive insight, you can optimize your cognitive performance. You can measure and monitor your own or your family's mental health and fitness.
Basically, what we're talking about here is headgear that senses electrical patterns in your brain. It can tell if you're excited or relaxed or focused, and that information can be used to, say, control a video game. Believe it or not, they just held the second annual Neurogaming Expo in San Francisco.
It's happening somewhat faster than we thought.
This is Howard Chizik. He's a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Washington.
A couple of the new products that have shown up are already along the pathway that I think we thought were probably a couple years away.
And that's why Chizik and some grad students have scrambled to set up this research project.
So it should be very tight, but it shouldn't be too uncomfortable.
They put a sensor cap on a human subject, in this case me, and then they have him play a fiendishly difficult video game they call Flappy Whale.
You're 2,600. 28.
No!
Up to 27.
be the game. Be the whale.
Now, while the human subject concentrates on flying the whale through barriers, occasional images flicker on the monitor. They're logos for fast food or coffee shops. The sensor cap records the subject's responses to those logos.
By putting something on your head, you're actually providing an extra source of information.
Grad student Tamara Bonacci says that information that's leaking from your skull while you play the game can be very revealing.
Consequences of providing that signal without thinking about it are probably similar to the consequences of giving your DNA sample to some online database.
Really? Wearing a skull cap while playing a game is comparable to sharing DNA? It seems far-fetched. But Professor Chizik says the day may come when millions of people play online games while wearing these things. Whoever controls the game could play a kind of 20 questions, collecting players' emotional responses to whatever they flash on the screen.
I could flash pictures of male-male, female-female, male-female couples and see which ones you react to. And going through sort of a logic tree, I could extract your sexual orientation. I could show political candidates and begin to understand your political orientation and then sell that to pollsters.
Of course, this is all still very theoretical, but that's why they're doing the research and why it's being funded by the National Science Foundation. If they can figure out what the privacy threats are ahead of time, maybe they can propose ways to build in security from the start. Chizik says we shouldn't repeat the mistakes that were made in the early days of the Internet.
When email started, defense against malware and spam and all sorts of other things was not built in. And, you know, now it's actually a question whether we can ever have a secure Internet.
If Chizik and his team are successful, maybe we can avoid future news stories about the stubborn problem of brain spyware. Martin Kosty, NPR News, Seattle.
There are a lot of business people who would love to fly small unmanned aircraft, drones, all over this country, delivering packages, taking photos, but they've got a problem. The law. There is a battle in the courts right now about whether it's legal to fly little drones in the sky and about who exactly owns the air. Here's Steve Henn from our Planet Money team.
This philosophical question goes back before the airplane to English common law. Actually, to the Middle Ages. I never took Latin, but there is a Latin phrase that's relevant here.
You know, I'm not sure I'm even pronouncing this right.
Stuart Banner is a law professor at UCLA.
Cujus est solum, aegis et est usque ad coelum.
Translation, he who owns the soil owns up to the heavens. In England, this was the law of the land for centuries.
The earliest cases involved things like overhanging tree branches, buildings that were built lopsided, so they leaned into the neighbor's airspace and so on.
During the Middle Ages, this worked great, but enter hot air balloons and then airplanes, not so much.
Wouldn't an aviator be trespassing everywhere that he flew?
Banner says during the early days of aviation, there were all sorts of proposals to solve this trespassing problem.
Including, you know, ideas that sound pretty silly in retrospect, like, you know, making airplanes fly above streets.
Imagine if every transcontinental flight had to follow I-80. That wouldn't work. So in 1926, Congress creates what we now call the FAA and declared that the air above the minimum safe altitude of flight is a public domain. Above 500 feet, roughly public property. And for a while, everyone seems okay with this, except there is this one guy who is not okay with it at all. His name, Thomas Lee Cosby.
Yeah, the Cosbys were chicken farmers in North Carolina who were near what was a tiny airport that was barely used.
During World War II, the Army takes over the airport and suddenly big military planes are flying over Cosby's chicken coops all the time.
All the chickens died. They had to give up chicken farming. They had a baby who, you know, couldn't sleep.
So Cosby sues. The case goes all the way to the Supreme Court, and he wins. The court rules landowners might not own the sky to the heavens, but they do still own it up to at least 83 feet. To recap, Congress says above 500 feet, this is a public highway. The air below 83 feet, According to the courts, that belongs to landowners like Cosby. But this decision left a gap. It created unclaimed territory in the air. And it is that territory that pilots of tiny little unmanned aircraft, little drones, have their eyes on.
Pause. That's going to go right over your head, man, if you don't mind.
Meet Cy Brown, drone pilot and kind of a character.
As long as it doesn't go on my head.
There's this video of Cy at a fishing camp where he lures a big old alligator into the dock using his bare toes as bait. And then bops him on the head.
You got him.
Yeah, I popped him right on the nose.
Do it again.
Well, how about we do it with your toes?
Cy is willing to try stuff that wouldn't even occur to most people, which is honestly how he got into drones. Where he lives in Louisiana, there's this problem. Feral wild pigs. They run around wrecking everyone's crops. They're hard to get rid of. They're hard to find in a field with waist-high rice. But Cy came up with an idea.
You ready?
He took this little remote control airplane, a drone, really, and equipped it with heat-seeking sensors. Then he flies this thing over fields at night. It sends video back to his laptop. The little piggies glow on the screen, and he guides in a buddy with a gun.
Pig, in the tracks with you. There you go. Get him. Shoot him more.
Even the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, liked Cy's idea. In fact, they wanted to copy it. But when I asked Cy last month if he'd take me hunting, he said no. Turns out his little drone had been grounded. I asked him what was going on and kind of paused. This guy who sticks his bare feet into a bayou and wiggles around his toes to tease an alligator told me I'd have to talk to his attorney, which I did. And it turns out that the Federal Aviation Administration has been sending out cease and desist letters to commercial drone pilots all over the country, threatening big fines for flying little drones. The FAA says for safety reasons, that unclaimed airspace, that is still regulated by them. But this is still an unsettled legal question. Drone pilots are fighting back in federal courts, and guys like Cy are waiting for someone to tell them if or when they can fly. Steve Henn, NPR News.
We turn now to an event happening this weekend that will bring software developers, entrepreneurs, local governments, and community members together to design and build tools for the common good. Using publicly released data, they will work together to create all kinds of projects, from fixing potholes to stocking food banks, basically integrating technology to solve community issues. The event is known as the National Day of Civic Hacking. Here to tell us more is one of the organizers, Ted Kozane. He's the founder of Second Muse. That's a collaborative innovation lab that helps find technological solutions to everyday issues. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So back up and tell me, what is civic hacking?
So a civic hacker is really a community member. This can be an engineer, a software developer, a designer, an entrepreneur, sort of really anybody that cares about their community and cares about actually influencing it. And civic hacking is when these folks actually work with each other, including folks within the government, including who are included in that group, to find ways to just improve the quality of life in their communities.
What kinds of projects do you tend to gravitate toward? Because I think some people might be intrigued by this. On the one hand, volunteerism is such a fundamental part of American life. On the other hand, I think some people might say, fixing potholes, that's the government's job. They're supposed to do that. Why should people volunteer to do something that we know that's their job?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. My sense is that because we know more about what's going on sort of within our communities, and that there's such tremendous capacity that there's many ways where citizens can actually plug in and provide solutions and ideas, and that traditionally were held within one – within, for, say, the government or within, say, for example, some kind of an NGO or something like that. But we see people come up with novel solutions that integrate, you know, these different sort of segments of society that have traditionally been very segmented to come together in really novel ways. And so you see people doing a whole range of things from – you know, building websites that help, you know, that help people without homes find homes for the evening, or people that are hungry find food from, you know, healthy food sources. And that, of course, involves, you know, the government working together to make sure that certain standards are in place, as well as, you know, software programmers to bring their talents from their day jobs to actually, you know, help really solve a problem that exists in the community.
You know, I've seen an example of this up close, you know, after Hurricane Katrina, when a lot of people went up to Houston to find, you know, safety. And a lot of people had to leave so quickly, they didn't have address books, or particularly, you know, seniors who perhaps didn't have, or they perhaps left phones behind where they had numbers programmed in and couldn't find relatives. And I saw, you know, hackers kind of descend upon the stadium there in Houston, where a lot of people were finding emergency shelter, and set up systems right there to help people find relatives and loved ones around the country. It was quite amazing to see, and it was kind of a but it was an emergency situation where there literally could not have been a system in place. Can you give us another example of where hackers have gotten together to kind of solve a problem, perhaps on a more ongoing basis, or to solve a more ongoing problem?
Yeah, and that's a great example. I think in the aftermath of Katrina is when we saw a real explosion of this kind of, like, you know, people who had a lot to give, but what they wanted to give was not a $5 donation. They, you know, they wanted to build a website, or, you know, or find a lot of those. You know, of course, you're referring to the, you know, one of many person finders websites that popped up in the emergency situation. So, I mean, one of the examples of what we saw come out of last year, for example, is was an initiative called OMG Transit. And so, you know, if you're interested in multimodal transportation, that means I want to, you know, use a bus and maybe a car sharing program and maybe a train and then maybe some other form of transportation. There were no apps to be able to take you from end to end to say, you know, how do I get from point A to point B using the public infrastructure. And this was a group of people that literally just came together. They met each other in Minneapolis, and then they came up with a really interesting sort of application. And then, you know, throughout the course of, you know, the next 6 months, we worked with them actually quite closely. And they're a proper up and running business right now, where they're really building this, and it's been an ongoing year long initiative.
You know, Edward Snowden is in the news now. We mentioned him just briefly a few minutes ago. What about the fact that, you know, NASA and the White House are taking part in this? So some citizens have some not warm feelings about their government right now, feeling that the government's overreached in accessing information about citizens that they should not necessarily have access to. Are you at all concerned about, you know, privacy issues or breaking down walls, not just for the government or for private sector players who are getting access to information they really shouldn't have about people? Is that at all a concern?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's clearly a concern, and I think we're seeing it play out. I think that, you know, what we're seeing is that, you know, there's been this really big explosion of data, you know, and people have access to lots of data about people. And we're having a really interesting conversation right now about what information should you have access to, what information shouldn't you have access to. I think that what we focus over here is not necessarily on saying we should open up data that is questionable in terms of whether we should have access to it or not. What we're really focusing on is inaccessible yet acceptable data. So there's NASA, for example, generates tons of data through other satellites, both looking into space, as well as they have a lot of satellites that are looking at Earth, looking at climate change patterns and things like that. I think what we're interested in is taking data that everybody agrees is not innocuous, but is not sort of within this realm of conflict about should this data be available or not. And we're actually just making this accessible. So you have 18 different federal agencies that are involved that are opening up data sets, and this is not controversial data. This is sort of data that nobody would object to, but that is maybe sitting in a corner and actually is not being used well, and that's really kind of the data that we're focusing on.
You know, you're telling us that there are events all over the country. What, something like over more than 100 events, right, taking place this weekend?
That's right. Yeah, there's 100 and about, I think we're up to 123 events in 103 different cities.
And what are some of the things that you like about it? And I know that one of the things you were telling us is that this is the kind of event that brings together people who don't normally sit in a room together, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like, you know, I mean, because of the fact that the difference between what should the government be doing versus what should the private sector be doing versus what should a community volunteer be doing, because they've gotten so intermingled, you know, a lot of times, I mean, we can sort of clash and say, this is your job, this is my job, or we can get into the room together and actually see each other face to face and meet each other. And that diversity of opinion from so many different multiple backgrounds, when it's coming together for the intent of actually understanding some kind of a challenge or opportunity and then working together to fix it, has turned out to be very powerful. And we have, you know, a library of evidence of, you know, of what that is able to create. And it's really rich what comes out of there, just because I think it's not an antagonistic meeting. It's a really it's a very additive, a very constructive sort of an event.
How will you judge the success of this, you know, overall? If you and I get together 5 years from now, what do you hope will have happened as a result of the work that's going on this weekend and around the country and around the world?
I think that there's probably a number of factors. I think that we want to see real stuff happen. So we want to see, you know, not something that happens over a weekend and then sort of disappears, but we want to see, you know, kind of what you alluded to earlier, which is ongoing initiative that actually is helping people, that is actually solving challenges, that's starting new businesses. We also want to see this influence, and we're already seeing it really influence both local government as well as federal government in terms of their ability to, because there's a lot of data there. And again, we're talking about the data that's not controversial, but we're seeing a lot of people open that up. And I think that watching more of that is going to be one of the factors of success.
Todd Kozane is the co-founder of Second Muse. We've been talking to him about events this weekend around civic hacking. And to learn more, you can go to npr.org/tellmemore. Todd, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Michelle.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Apple confirmed this week that it plans to buy Beats by Dre for $3 billion, one of the largest acquisitions in its history. But Beats Electronics is not known for making the greatest headphones. So what's in it for Apple? Well, they get a music mogul, Jimmy Iovine, and a popular streaming service. And as NPR's Sam Sanders reports, Apple also wants to get into the smart headphones business.
First, there was Apple with those little white earbuds.
One, two, three, take my hand and come with me because you look so fine that I really want to make you mine.
Then came Beats by Dre. I'm Beats by Dre changed the headphone game almost overnight. They're flashy, cool, a fashion statement. As one critic said, the Air Jordans of headwear. But most reviewers say Beats headphones aren't actually that good.
Every time I've listened to them, I think, oh, right, I really don't like these.
Whitson Gordon is the editor-in-chief of Lifehacker. He's reviewed Beats headphones for the site. And he says they make everything sound like live music. In a bad way.
Yeah, it's almost like when you go to a concert and you're standing too close to the speakers and you're just hearing this booming noise, and sometimes you can't even tell what their song they're playing and you can't hear the mids and the highs. That's what listening to Beats is like for me.
So if not for the audio fidelity, why would Apple spend $3 billion for this technology?
Apple has a great deal of interest in putting sensors of various types in headphones and making headphones smart.
That's Tyle Hertzen of the audio review website innerfidelity.com. He says Apple's not really concerned with making the best sound in headphones. They're trying to make smart headphones, headphones that can monitor a lot about you.
Temperature, pulse, perspiration, sensors for athletic tracking applications, position sensing so that they can tell when your head is moving.
Earlier this year, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office gave Apple a patent for a sports monitoring system for headphones. The patent says the devices would also be able to tell when the user is speaking or know if the headphones are in your ears or not. Dan Frakes of Macworld says it's much easier for Apple to integrate that new technology with a company like Beats, which already has a big headphone infrastructure, than for Apple to build that up from scratch.
They just sort of accelerated their process from a logistical standpoint because now they've got the resources to design and produce something.
Big companies like Intel and LG already have smart headphone prototypes that they've been showing off at tech shows. And small companies and startups are in the game as well. One European company named Braggy just finished a successful Kickstarter campaign to fund what they call the Dash. The headphones are already in pre-order. Jim Neinsling runs Braggy's U.S. operation. Neinsling says ultimately, smart headphones won't just monitor things like heart rate. They'll actually be able to tell what you're doing.
You don't have to tell it that you're biking.
It knows. You don't have to tell it you're swimming. It knows by your body movements.
Bragi's Kickstarter campaign raised over $3 million. Ninesling says people know that smart headphones and other, quote, wearable technology, like those bracelets that monitor your sleep patterns, are going to be big.
A lot of different people that are speculating that the wearables industry will exceed $30 billion. I've heard estimates as high as $50 billion in sales revenues by 2018.
If Apple wants to, it shouldn't be that hard for the company to grab a big chunk of that pie. Besides their dominant market share, Apple has a loyal, even rabid, customer base. So if Apple and Beats by Dre decide headphones that tell you how fast your heart beats or how good a runner you are cool, chances are lots of people will probably believe them. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
People have been dying to get a glimpse of Google's completely autonomous self-driving car for a while now. Finally, on Tuesday, Google pulled back the curtains.
Oh, isn't that cute?
Go ahead and buckle up.
Okay, Eddie. There's no steering wheel in the way.
The Google video is like an iPad ad. The gentle music, the real people who quickly get over the weirdness of a car with no steering wheel or brake pedal, and are soon giggling as they enjoy their ride. Brad Templeton has written extensively about self-driving cars and has advised Google on their program. I asked him, how long before we're seeing these things out on the road?
Well, Google has said they're going to be letting people, non-Google employees, into it fairly soon, within a year. Now, actually, making it for sale or available for rent is far more likely as something that'll come a bit later. But the car companies have been saying they'll be selling offerings by 2020 themselves. And Google originally said 2017. Elon Musk said that Tesla would sell a car by 2016. Volvo has said they'll have people in cars in around that time, too. So it's definitely going to be on the roads in the later part of this decade and really taking over the world in the 2020s.
What do you think are the biggest hurdles that remain between now and then in terms of getting the car out there in numbers?
Well, the answer to your first question actually is the hurdle, because there isn't a fixed date. What there is a goal of making a vehicle that drives more safely than people do. Now, that's both easy because people drive very badly, but also very hard at the same time. And everyone involved is really just focused on making it possible to prove that they've made a vehicle that safe, and then they'll sell them as soon as they believe they can do that. Google has a big lead in that area. They've announced that they've done at least 700,000 miles of testing of their vehicles on the roads around California. Other companies aren't nearly as far along, but they're all working on it.
So you've been thinking about this for a while, and I know that once the driverless car is on the road for you, that's just the start. How will this affect the design of the car?
Well, what Google's done is particularly interesting there, because their cars don't have a steering wheel, and their cars that can operate unmanned, which means they can actually deliver themselves to you. This is a car which can go off and recharge or refuel itself, and this is a car which can go and park and store itself. And those things have big consequences for the energy we use in transportation and for our cities. Many people don't realize just how much of our lives in our cities we've given over to the car. A quarter of the energy in the United States goes to personal transportation, a quarter of the greenhouse gases. So it's really such a huge part of our lives, even when you forget about the biggest thing of all, which is the 33,000 Americans who die in car accidents every year, and the millions more who are injured.
Do you see any downside here? I would at least think that there's going to be job loss from people who drive for a living.
That's certainly true. And unlike people who build an industrial robot, who build it for the purpose of replacing a worker, nobody is building this for the purpose of replacing a worker. It's going to happen, but it's not the goal of the people working on it. Now, there are other downsides possible, too. There are people who might take this, instead of going green with it, they might decide they want to live 3 hours away from the city and sleep on their commute every day. We could get more sprawl instead of less. We could get people who don't walk anywhere anymore, and so they don't get fitness. We could get governments demanding that they have control of the vehicles and they can take them over and tell your car to take you to jail, like happens in the movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise. We could see our privacy invaded. The NSA is already watching everything we do. Soon they'll be able to watch everywhere we go. Nothing is perfect. Nothing is without its downsides. But boy, as you may have mentioned, 1.2 million people around the world killed every year in car accidents. That's like curing one of the world's most dangerous diseases. And it's worth the risk of those downsides to try and do that.
That's Brad Templeton. You can read more of his thoughts on driverless cars at his website, templetons.com. Brad, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, too. And I hope to see you in a self-driving car soon.